Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, a podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 from a waffle stand here in 2022. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Dybart.
I'm Felisco.
Before I introduce our guest, did you notice that I said we are a podcast, not the podcast?
Correct.
I'm slowly transitioning into, you know, the ether. Today, back together for maybe the last time, Mike Natale, Tom Lorenzo, our favorite Italians. Great to see you guys.
Italians.
I'm so
like 1.5 Italians.
Natale, what's the other? I mean, obviously Irish. I can look at your face.
Irish. Yeah.
That is the face that's colonized many a people.
Yeah. It's mainly Irish, Italian, and what they describe as Eastern European Jew.
That's me, baby.
Just like. Which is just, I don't know. It's like the Johnny Cash song. I've been everywhere. We just keep, you know.
There have been so many countries there in the same exact place where they can't really say you're Polish or German or Romanian or, you know, we're just Eastern European.
Hell, the town that my great-grandfather is from was Polish, then German, and is now, I shit you not, Russian, despite the fact that it is not connected to Russia in any way and sits in the middle of Poland. Real weird.
So, yeah. so you're saying Russia likes to take things that's not theirs? Interesting.
Yeah. Who knew?
I'm not saying that. Tom,
let me just read a newspaper real quick and take a sip of my coffee.
So what happened a few weeks ago was I tweeted that I was having difficulty finding guests for the Palme d'Or winner Rosetta. Also to our listeners, I apologize.
Get cultured, people.
My voice is a little, I have a cold. It's not COVID, thankfully, but I have a little bit of a cold. So my apologies about my voice. So I went on Twitter and I was like, hey, I can't find a guest for Rosetta. And Mike Natale raised his hand as he wants to do, generally speaking, when it comes to tweets like this. And I was like, fuck yeah, let's bring Mike and Tom back for everyone's favorite Belgian story that won the Palme d'Or
unanimously
in 1999.
Everyone's favorite comedy, Rosetta.
I do want to, at some point in this episode, talk a little general, because I do feel like we haven't really talked about that, Kenny, in terms of the 99 can.
No, we
so Kenny's now going to look up what won a can.
Well, I know what won it can. Yeah. We're doing it. But I have to look up what the Cannes Film Festival actually is. So give me a second.
It's
a film festival in France.
It is. I mean, listen, we can actually just start there for all intents and purposes. Because there's a part of me that's like, the Palme d'Or is one of those awards that within film circles is obviously very meaningful because hoity-toity people think that the French, you know, mean something. And I guess they do to some people. Not to Tom, though. It's also one of those weird
French things. The French are way better than the English.
But it's also not even to say, close. This specific award is one of those awards that I feel like periodically a studio will be like, we can use this to get some box office dollars, right? Like, it's won the Palme d'Or. It'll get people to come out and see it. And more times than not, North America-wise, it doesn't really move the needle very much. It does periodically. I mean, a Pulp Fiction winning is a big deal.
An American film winning is a big deal.
I would counter that it still helps in a smaller way. Let's face it, Parasite won the Palme d'Or, and that put it in the map in a big way.
That was a huge deal.
Listen, yeah. I'm going to be real with you. I don't know. You know, you can sit down and look at raw box office numbers if you want and say it doesn't. But I can tell you, look, I'm on Long Island. Titan, the French serial killer fucks a car movie, opened in some theaters in Long Island based on the fact that it won the Palme d'Or. Going to happen.
When it's a movie like Titan, it does help. When it's a movie that's like these crazy French people. When it's a movie like Rosetta, it doesn't help because it's these obvious French people. So it really, you know, I think that, yeah, I do think that it's not in Parasite. I would also put into the Titan category, which is like, oh, you guys have, you know, you varied interest. You're not total boring prudes. But I wanted to real fast refill. We did a lot of films that were in competition at Cannes this year.
Oh, did we?
A ton, including some of the greats. So I'll just rattle off the ones that we actually did.
Great.
All About My Mother. True. Cradle Will Rock, Felicia's Journey, Ghost Dog, Limbo, Straight Story. So those are the ones that we've actually done.
Those were in competition.
All in competition. Then I feel like Tom or Mike might have better pronunciation. Un Certain Regard.
Sure.
The only one here is actually a movie we haven't done, but we're about to do. Oh, no, there's two. So Ratcatcher.
Yep.
Played there.
That was a big one. Yeah.
And also The Winslow Boy, which, you know, is one of our famous lost episodes. Out of competition are the fun ones. Out of competition, they did Dogma, EdTV, Entrapment, EdTV? An Ideal Husband, The Limey.
Fuck.
And my best thing by
Entrapment? I can't. Do you imagine
Do you know why? Like, let's talk about Cannes for a minute.
Catherine Zeta-Jones.
No, because Kenny talked about like
the butt shot.
Hoity-toity French people. No, but you're talking about hoity-toity French people. So Cannes, you know, was the reason.
I'm sorry, what was that? What did you say?
The Cannes Film Festival.
No, it's Cannes. Sorry,
it's Cannes.
It's Cannes.
Okay, the Cannes Film Festival.
I'm kidding.
Whatever makes it. Listen, guys, it's your waffle stand.
That's right.
And
my illegal waffles.
I like that it's your waffle stand, and much like Rosetta, anytime we're on, we kind of bully our way into taking over that waffle stand for a little bit. But there's part of the reason it had the prestige that it has is, of course, it's all these films of the world coming together and these great filmmakers. And if you look at the early days of the Palme d'Or and the early days of the Cannes Film Festival, you just see some incredible and exciting stuff. But part of the problem with Cannes, I would say, in the last like 30, 40 years is that they tend to just, at this point, select films based on who's been here before, who's a name, who's this, who's that. And it really doesn't, like, you know,
they use it as a launching pad. I mean, the reality is that, you know, when you premiere Elvis at Cannes, you're not necessarily out of competition.
Yeah.
You're basically just saying, like, we just want to have a bunch of pictures and do a big glitzy premiere.
But
or whatever.
I'm saying it more in the idea of like the standard at which it's now. I mean, and a perfect example is, and I don't mean to dismiss them right off the bat. I actually really like their films, but like the Dardenne brothers are the epitome of that. Every single fucking movie they have plays at Cannes every goddamn year, everyone. And it does kind of feel like it's Khan, in some ways, when I look at the selections, and there are some good ones that do, you know, some great films that do break through. But like even looking at this list from this year, you know, in certain cases, you look at things and you're like, did this get in just because it is so-and-so's name attached or this person starring in it? I mean, it feels a little bit like the Emmys insofar as it's like people complain about the Emmys now where they're basically like the easiest way to get an Emmy nomination is to have already won. And like they kind of just keep picking the same things. Sure. Khan can be a bit wearying in like in looking at that lineup.
You're totally right. I almost can't conceive of a film festival with purely meritocratic standards. In fact, I think you guys should start with because this is what film festivals are built on, right? Film festivals just, you know, little star fuckeries, and you know, and whether these stars are big or small or what exactly they're signaling to the people, to their in groups or whatever. But it would be really lovely to see a film festival with standards where the newest Ardenne Brothers movie didn't get in because it didn't meet the standards of inclusion.
No, for sure. The reality is that film festivals by and large, I mean, I was talking to my friend when I was home for TIFF last month, and you know, we were talking about the days when like TIFF was about film goers, you know, and it was about going to see movies, and it was about, there's still a lot of movies that play at TIFF and a lot of movies that play at most festivals that will never even see the light of day, which is obviously disappointing. But like the reality is that there's just not money in that, right? I mean, it all comes down to the bottom line, which is dollars. And these film festivals need to find ways to line their pockets to keep themselves up and running. And it's disappointing, but it's the reality. I do want to talk about just a quick rundown of just some Palme d'Or winners for our listeners.
Wait, before you do that, I want to make one more point about this because we've talked about Sundance a little bit. We haven't really talked about Cannes that much. Cannes isn't really, you know, the kind of film festival I'm talking about right now. But what's particularly galling and disappointing is of all these film festivals, Sundance, Cannes, even South By at this point, they're all such star fuckers that it's almost impossible for a true independent movie to break through at the film festival level. Mm-hmm. Right. So if you can't break through at the film festival level, how exactly can someone who is not in some way connected to an established player break through in a way that I think people used to be able to? You know, really, there really used to be the dream of the $1 million movie running the table and actually getting a nomination or actually making, you know, more than its money back or actually birthing a person's entire career. That really happened all the time. And you have to kind of go to, I don't even know how you do it at this point. I don't know how you do it. I don't know where that Venn diagram of film festivals that are kind of open to people outside of the in crowd and film festival and film festivals that are covered enough where a movie that breaks out will actually, you know, have a life beyond the film festival.
And to your point, Kenny, like it's even more egregious than most people realize because an Oscar category that I pay attention to that I think five other people pay attention to is the shorts, right? That's usually everyone's bathroom break.
So you're looking forward to Taylor Swift winning this year?
Well, so this is the thing. When they were like, oh, Taylor Swift.
Yes.
No, I don't give a shit because this is how it's been for a while. That's the thing that most people don't realize. Mm-hmm. When they were like, oh, Taylor Swift might win the Oscar for the
short. Riz Ahmed won last year.
The year before that was a Daily Show writer. And the year before that was like a multi-nominee.
I think one.
No. Well, Kobe won for animated. I'm just talking about live action.
Trayvon Free won.
So. Yeah, like it has been, when you look at the people who have actually won recently, like the last time that somebody, a true unknown, like amateur filmmaker by the broadest definition, won that Oscar, it was in like 2010. It was Luke Matheny for God of Love. And even then, he was in his master's program at NYU and certainly knew people to talk to. So the fact is, like these film festivals, it's not just a matter of not being able to make a $1 million feature and get it into this festival, or the fact that, you know, the Indie Spirit Awards are basically, you know, synonymous with the Oscars, except for one stray nomination. Now, not even the short films can get traction.
I was really bitching about the Indie Spirit Award last year. Indie Spirit Award. I mean, a Netflix movie from a, hate the term, but I think it's relevant here, from a Nepo baby, massive star made for like $8 million. It's not an independent movie starring a fucking Best Actress winner. It's not an independent movie in the sense
of... Which movie
of,
is this? Forgive me. I can't remember.
This is The Lost Daughter.
Of course.
Yes. Which is, it's just not what, it's not an independent spirit. Yeah. And it doesn't take away from the movie at all, at all. It certainly has the right to exist. It just doesn't have the right to take awards from these actual independent movies.
It's funny that we all sound like old men complaining about things these days.
I am an old man. I am an old man.
Brothers McMullen could never win these days, I tell
you. Tom, you look like you wanted to say something. Please speak.
Listen, I'm going to be an old man that complains too. You know, I mean, I think it all just comes down to like a myopia with everything. It's, you know, all of these film festivals, they have their own personalities basically. So like whatever is big and popular, whatever at Cannes is big, splashy at Cannes, you're not going to get the same experience at TIFF or South By. You're not going to get the same experience at Fantastic Fest, which maybe is probably the closest you can get to at this point.
Fantastic Fest was the one I was thinking, and Beyond Fest, but
like,
I don't know.
Like you could actually find independent movies, foreign movies that aren't, you know, they had Parasite its big year, but they always have like South Korean films or Japanese films and films from people that aren't like big, well-known names, you know? There's movies that are always premiering there that show up a year or two later on Shudder or whatever, you know, that aren't big splashy things, but then they premiere and then people kind of, the word comes out. But even then there's, you know, a sort of myopia to what they pick. They're not going to show the newest Dardanes Brothers movie. And I think there's something to be said about each fest having its own personality, but I think the more successful and more ingrained these festivals get, the more, I don't know, you know, they start smelling their own farts basically, and they don't start taking chances. And it kind of gets to a discussion me and Mike have all the time, which is I feel like 95% of people that, you know, compromise film Twitter or film fandom, they're not really film fans. They have films and types of films that they like, and that's what they think every movie should be. And they don't want to branch out into other things. So, you know, each festival has its own personality. The kind of people that, you know, spend thousands of dollars to go to France to fucking, you know, star fuck at Cannes, they're not going to Fantastic Fest to watch the newest indie movies or action horror, whatever things. And
vice versa as well.
Yeah. And I was going to say, as vice versa, the people that are going to Fantastic Fest to drink their minds rotten for 8 straight days are not going to France or going to Canada to see for TIFF or for, you know, like Cannes. So I think the film festival thing is pretty indicative of just what filmdom is at the point. It's segmented fandoms, and the Oscars are its own, you know, we joke all the time, there's plenty of movies that are just made to win Oscars. I haven't seen it yet, but watching the trailer in front of all fucking things, Pearl, Tar is not a movie that seems like it was made by anyone other than an algorithm made to get Cate Blanchett another Oscar.
Oh shit, Richard Brody's here. Really, Richard Brody's here.
It's a really good movie.
Gawker's coming to take down Tom.
Come at me, motherfuckers. I fight dirty.
You haven't seen it, Tom. When you see
I'm saying based off of watching the trailer and seeing a crowd full of horror movie fans, seeing that trailer, I'm going, what the fuck am I even watching?
Yeah, that the marketing of Tar is not Tar anything.
Guys, both of these things, and not a movie can be kind of algorithmically, you know, made to win an Oscar and also be great. We've seen
oh,
so
I'm not
many.
Saying it's not going to be great.
I know you're not. That's the point I'm making. I know you're not. I think what we're seeing is there's only, in my opinion, 3 ways for a movie to make money in the theaters anyway. Big fucking tentpole, you know, hard genre, or Oscar bait. That's it. So it's one of the three. It's one of the three real fucking avenues to make money commercially. Of course. You're going to try to make movies to win Oscars.
I mean, hell, Kenny brought up The Lost Daughter before, a movie that, by all intents and purposes, the second the Academy Awards ended this year, it ceased to exist.
Yeah.
It was a movie only made to get Olivia Colman and maybe Dakota Johnson, if the Oscars were feeling a little generous, Oscar nominations. It doesn't exist anymore. Go to Netflix. You'll type in The Lost Daughter and the TV will start laughing at you.
I mean, not a bad movie, but it's a movie that just doesn't exist. I do think, I mean, listen, you guys, I agree with everything you guys are saying. It's a tough time right now, you know, in terms of breaking through, in terms of actually getting people to watch your shit. It's hard to do. It's why streaming has obviously become such, you know, a big part of this industry. I think that, you know, to play devil's advocate to what you guys are saying, I do think that technology has made it that much easier to make films, to distribute films, to get films out into the world. That's a positive. It's, you know, getting people to engage with it. And you know, I think that generationally, we're seeing a divide in terms of the fact that people basically under the age of 35 don't really go to the movies. And if they do, it seems to be for horror movies or
aren't you guys under 35?
I'm sorry?
Yeah, I'm 32.
Yes. Yeah, Liz at the movie theater. You're right. It's a positive, Phil. You're right. It's a positive. What I think we're grappling with is it's a complete paradigm shift. And, what I'm frustrated by is the fact that so many movies just aren't going to get made. And I appreciate someone brought this up about The Blacklist or something like that, how all the top blacklist scripts, generally not all, but so many of the top blacklist scripts are serious dramas or period dramas or, you know, and then, you know, these occasional blacklist bait, which I've certainly written. So whatever. They're not the kind of movies that actually get made, you know?
Yeah.
Like the movies on the blood list are the kind of movies that actually get made. So then actually get an audience. So like, really, what is The Blacklist at this point? Like, it's kind of just it's a relic of what execs think make a good script.
I do wonder if The Blacklist, and again, I don't know the answer to this because I don't know shit about features really, or the future business, but like, I do wonder if it helps you get repped. Maybe. I don't know.
Oh, getting on The Blacklist fucking rules.
Okay.
Getting on The Blacklist is a fucking career maker. 100%, but it still is like, it still is rewarding people for something that, you know, doesn't actually make people money anymore.
100%, for sure.
Can I pivot back to the Palme d'Or like Phil was trying to do earlier?
Well, yeah, no, I was just gonna, let me read a couple of these titles so that our listeners have some sense
teacher's
of
pet.
I deal with this shit all the time.
So in 80, All That Jazz won, which obviously is a big Kenny. Big Kenny favorite.
Masterpiece.
Big Tom favorite too.
It won with Akira Kurosawa's Kajimusha. I don't know how you pronounce that, if I pronounce that correctly.
Hell of a movie.
Okay, cool. There's a bunch of, I mean, listen, Paris, Texas, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, which we talked about on our 89 Patreon. We talked about that a little bit, how that obviously was a big deal. It was an American film. It was the beginning of Soderbergh's illustrious career. Wild at Heart wins in 90. Barton Fink wins in 91. Then Lynch and the Coens split it again down the road. They split it, I believe, in 2000 or 2001. Didn't they split Best Director at Cannes?
Oh, I thought you meant the Palme d'Or. I'm like, 2000 is Dancer in the Dark.
Yeah, Dancer in the Dark wins in 2000, but they split. I might have been in 2001. Whenever The Man Who Wasn't There and Mulholland Drive came out, they split the Best Director thing between the two of them, which I think is interesting. Polanski's The Pianist wins. Elephant wins. Fahrenheit 9/11. Like, again, this is one of those things with Tree of Life. Recently, The Square, Shoplifters, an amazing Japanese film that if people haven't seen it, go watch that movie. It's just interesting. You know, blue is the warmest color. Amour. It's a wide spectrum of.
So are we doing the most boring?
It certainly seems to be the least showy.
No. So here's what I'll say about the Palme d'Or.
Phil just said the Tree of Life. Come on.
Love the Tree of Life.
here's what I'll say about the Palme d'Or. Here's what I'll say about the Palme d'Or that I think will appeal to Kenny a bit. On a Patreon episode, I think about Adventureland, so I'm not sure how this topic came up, but you guys know how you do. Kenny talked about the Oscars and Best Picture and talking about how what he wants from Best Picture is not necessarily the best movie, but the movie that reflects the time. Because of the jury structure of Cannes, Yeah. And because the jury changes every year, a fascinating thing about the Palme d'Or winners in most years, whether I think they're good or bad, right or wrong, a fascinating thing is that when you look at them, they are very reflective of the climate at the time.
Right.
And not necessarily.
Right. Does appeal to me. In it.
So, for example, we mentioned Fahrenheit 9/11 one, right? That,
sure.
The year Fahrenheit 9/11. Okay. Do you have any idea who ran the jury the year Fahrenheit 9/11 won?
I don't.
So in competition that year, the same year as Fahrenheit 9/11, is Old Boy by Park Chan-wook.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
The head of the jury is Quentin Tarantino.
Wow.
By all accounts, everyone would think, well, of course, he's going to push for Old Boy. But even Tarantino was like, look, it was the time. We all felt it. We were galvanized. Spielberg's jury is the one that gives it to Blue is the Warmest Color.
Yeah.
A guy who's, you know, but it's about the time and the climate. And if you look at, but if you look at Titan winning that year, people are like, oh, it's about fucking car. It was a movie. It is a movie entirely about gender and gender identity and struggle, you know, and the struggle to cover that at a time where that was, you know, that was the vibe.
Whose jury was that? I do know the answer to this one.
Titan last
year?
That
was Spike Lee's, wasn't it? Yeah, because he accidentally gave it away.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
I do want to. I don't disagree with you, Mike, but I also just want to throw in another element to it, mm-hmm. which I do think is that a lot of these filmmakers that run these juries also tend to back films that they could never make.
Yes.
Right. Like movies that are just completely outside their purview, which is why like the Rosetta wins. It's Cronenberg that's running the jury in 99. So like,
isn't that lovely? Everything you guys are saying is so nice. It makes me, it does, you know, in general, and I think we're four fantastic film fans who have, you know,
one of the best.
One of the best, one of the finest, you know, large purview, things that we appreciate. And I, you know, like, for instance, always kind of, you know, Spielberg, his films have, you know, a certain reputation, I guess. Sure. Soft would be the reputation for some of them. Soft and sentimental and cloying and whatever. But if you look at some of the filmmakers he's empowered, yeah, it's pretty wild. He made a fucking Toby Hooper movie. He took on the Kubrick film. I mean, he's just, he clearly has a pretty wide purview of things he enjoys. I think they all do. I think they all do. I think every great filmmaker loves everything from everywhere.
That's one of my favorite things about Nolan, is that Wally Pfister just kind of like outed him in an interview one time. Oh, he loves Michael Bay and he loves the Transformers movies.
Yeah.
It's like, really? Christopher Nolan, all people, is watching. Listen, the Transformers movies, miss them. Then they're going to keep making Transformers movies without Michael Bay. I don't give a fuck. They're not going to be insane. They're going to be safe, four quadrant bullshit pandering movies. And I don't care. I want to see Optimus Prime fight God. Okay.
There are many situations like that, right? Where these great filmmakers will like ride for some movie. You're like, you like that? But I do think making a movie, people who are actually on the inside of this, making a movie is so difficult and so hard. And making, and you're, like you said, Phil, making something that, unlike something that you make that you really can enjoy, is really, you know, kind of impressive. Like one of the most wild ones like ever is, I believe Sofia Coppola gave her like top 10 of all time and put Daddy's Home on the list. Right. And it's just, you know, I don't think she was doing it for cool points. I think she was just being honest.
I mean, it's, you know, it's like Paul Thomas Anderson talking about Big Daddy being one of his favorite films of 99, which for all intents and purposes makes sense with Punch Drunk Love coming out shortly thereafter. But I do think that, like, you know, I do think that when you really come down to it, can, even with all its starfuckery, even with all its repetition, I do think that as a film festival, and certainly that, you know, the awards that they give out are, you know, filled with merit. I do think that is, you know, the Palme d'Or does mean something. You know, I was just at TIFF, as I mentioned. I don't think the audience award really means much. In fact, to vote for the audience award, I'm not sure you even have to have seen the film. You just go on a website and you just like vote for it. So like, I don't even know that it actually really has much merit when everything is said and done. And it tends to go to a big Oscar, you know, movie coming down the pike. But I do think that the Palme d'Or, for all intents and purposes, does feel like the pinnacle film festival award. I don't know that anything really comes close to it.
I mean, so. I guess because it's, you know, it's filmmaker centric, basically, and you know who's giving out the awards. It's not like the Oscars sure. where it seems like nobody really still understands that the Oscars isn't like five guys in a room just handing out the awards every year. It's like a like each award is voted on by like each
right
union and shit. Like they keep saying, oh, the fucking Oscars, they did it again. It's like, no, it's like thousands of people voting. Like, I get it. It sucks that Green Book won, whatever. But like,
but like, but you make a good point, Tom, about like the jury itself. I mean, the most contentious one that I can think of and that comes off the top of my head is the Coppola year when he made such a stink at a Crash and was like simply refused to give it to Crash, so they created like. They basically gave it like an Audacity Award, essentially, which I think is absurd. What won that year? I can't even remember, Tom. I feel like Tom knows.
You're talking about the crash year?
Crash year?
Year at Cannes? What year was that? Does anybody remember?
That would have been like 95 or right?
Yeah, maybe 95.
Yes. Well, 94 would have been Pulp Fiction's year. So that's Eastwood running.
Well, because it came out
Underground?
95.
Is that
what? Oh, Underground. Underground's good.
Costa Rica. Yeah, it's one of the best movies ever. Yeah.
All right.
No, this is the weird thing with Cannes too, is there are certain movies that won the Palme d'Or that are very good that also just don't exist, that just you can't find anywhere.
Like Rosetta. It doesn't exist. Yeah. It is on HBO Max, and our listeners can go and watch it if they'd like. I'm going to give a little bit of context for Rosetta here so that people
like
know
what
we're talking about. Belgian 17-year-old Rosetta, played by Emily how do you say her last name? Does anyone know how to say her last name? My apologies.
It's probably Sanchez, Pat.
I'm going to say not.
This is.
I would have deferred to the Canadian on that one.
I said Dickinay. I don't know. Lives in a dilapidated trailer that has no running water, with her only indignant and alcoholic mother for company. After losing her job at a food processing plant, the teen struggles to find work in a bid to avoid falling into the same traps as her mother, but is rebuffed at every turn. Only Rike, who works at a nearby waffle stand, seems to care for Rosetta. But even that budding friendship has a price. Rosetta screened at the Cannes Film Festival, as we mentioned, where it won the Palme d'Or and Best Actress on September 29th, 1999. It later opened on November 5th, 1999, against The Bone Collector, The Bachelor, House on Haunted Hill, and The Insider. It would go on to make $5.6 million. It has 90% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 83% from audiences. Roger Ebert gave the film 3.5 stars and said, Rosetta is a young woman determined to find a job at all costs. She is escaping. She's escaping from the world of her alcoholic mother, a tramp who lives in a ramshackle trailer.
Gee, tell us how you really feel, Raj.
No, there are other kind of tramps, like a Charlie Chaplin tramp.
It's true. She's just
that's
like
right.
Charlie
Chaplin.
She did
Chaplin
have,
she did have a stick with a bag over her.
Yeah,
over her shoulder.
That's really what she is. She's a modern boxcar kid.
There's a Rosencrantz Guildenstern movie where she's at like the asylum and she's just getting into hijinks and everything, and she's leading like a patient uprising.
Rosetta lives in a ramshackle trailer and runs away near the beginning of the story, leaving her daughter to fend for herself. That's the mother. Rosetta sees an abyss yawning beneath her and will go to any lengths to avoid it. Her story is told in the film that astonishingly won the Palme d'Or at the 1999 Cannes Film Festival, as well as Best Actress for its star. The wins were surprising, not because this is a bad film, in its uncompromising way, it's a very good one, but because films like this, neorealist, without pedigree, downbeat, stylistically straightforward, do not often win it can. Variety's grudgingly positive review categorized it as an extremely small European art film from Belgium. Not just European, but Belgian. What happens next, I will leave for you to discover. The film has an odd subterranean power. It doesn't strive for a sympathy or make any effort to portray Rosetta as a colorful, winning, or sympathetic character. It's a film of economic determinism, the story of a young woman for whom employment equals happiness. Or so she thinks, until she has employment and is no happier. Perhaps because that is something she simply has never learned to be. Yeah, I mean, I didn't have any idea what this movie was about. When I press play on this thing, and I don't know about you, Kenny, did you look up anything about this beforehand?
No, I mean, literally only the HBO Max synopsis, which basically is a girl will do anything to get a job.
So neither of you guys had seen this before, is what you're saying?
No. And my only acknowledgement of this film, okay, if I'm being completely honest, if I'm being completely frank, I think we would have covered it just because I like to think we would have done the Palme d'Or winner.
Oh, I know the reason we both covered it.
David Sims put it on his fucking, like, yeah, you're the top.
David
of his
Sims
top
had it as number four on his top 10 of the year, and we found right. that to be compelling.
Well, so, when we went to New York and we talked with David Sims about Mystery Men, I remember he went through his list kind of. He's like, you guys going to talk about Rosetta? And in the back of my head, I was like, now we are. I mean, like, I genuinely probably.
He had Beau Travail very high, which we've done, and we're very happy we did it. And Rosetta, there was very high. And Rosetta, I don't even think I had heard of it at that point.
Neither did I.
So
no idea.
So
I'm the only person who saw this.
I thought Phil misspelled something when he sent the message on Twitter. I'm like, Rosetta, what the fuck is he talking about? I'm not trying to learn a new language today. What is he saying? Come on.
Yeah. I mean, I think Rosetta Stone, which is literally where my brain goes. And then obviously there's this whole Rosetta Law thing, which came into play after this movie came out, but was not actually a correlate. Basically, there's this law in Belgium prohibiting employers from paying teen workers less than minimum wage, which came into play after this film, but was not actually in any way connected to this film.
I love this. Is such a different energy than I thought I was coming into for this one, man.
You thought we would have seen this film?
Yeah. But more than that, I was just expecting, Tom and I were making jokes like when you first messaged us, because we were both at Comic-Con at the time, and about how, like, well, you know, if we're all swept up in Dardenne brothers talk and Tom doesn't want to talk about that, he could just pull out facts about Season of the Witch or something. And in fact, we've gone the opposite route. So I'm the only one who saw this prior to a week ago.
Well, you guys thought that we would be like big Dardenne heads.
No, I didn't
think figured big dark I'll be honest. Just, Can I be I, honest? I thought at the very least Phil would have, for the fact that I assumed because you would have come to it the same way I did, which is in 2014, 2 Days, One Night comes out with the Marion Cotillard performance that everybody was talking about, got the Oscar nomination. And when 2 Days, One Night came out, that was my first time seeing a Dardenne brothers movie. And then I looked and I'm like, because it was so hard, especially at that time, for a foreign language performance to break through in the Oscar acting. So 2 Days, One Night, and it got got a theatrical release here on the island. So I was able to see it, and it like had a big buzz. And then when you find out that this movie, which is a very compelling movie, is made by one of the only filmmakers to win 2 Palme d'Ors, that sent me to go like, all right, that's pretty. If they're up there with Francis Ford Coppola, I should
I'll
probably
say this.
Check
I'll,
these out.
I'll say this, Mike. I'm flattered.
You should be flattered. I'm insulted.
I'm flattered that you thought I would have done all of that legwork. that I would have put all of this together. That I just appreciate that. But you know,
that's just what Mike does. He does a lot of work. It's all homework.
I appreciate that about him. I think that's great.
Can I just say? How funny would it have been for somebody to do a double feature in 99 of this movie and House on Haunted Hill?
Yeah.
Incredible. I mean, holy. I mean, I would have done it because I'm a fucking psychopath. But like, imagine like just some family like, oh, yeah, we're in whatever L.A. for the weekend. We got some time to kill. Let's see some movies at the Chinese theater or whatever. We're going to go see House on Haunted Hill, new spooky movie. And then Rosetta. H, what can that be? Oh my God!
What's the weirdest double feature you guys have done in the theaters?
Max Payne and W.
That's a good one.
Mine actually includes an Oliver Stone movie as well.
Is it Any Given Sunday?
No, mine was a triple feature.
Oh shit! Okay, go ahead.
One of the greats of all time.
Okay,
I saw. I believe it was Mighty Ducks 2. No! My bad. Pulling back, it was Sudden Death. Wrong hockey movie.
Sure.
Into Grumpy Old Men or Grumpier Old Men.
Mm-hmm. Hell yeah.
Into Nixon.
Hell damn. Yeah.
Wait, Nixon was your chaser?
So it was, I saw two movies with friends in the morning. Like it was, it was like an 11 and a two or whatever. And my parents and I had plans to go, and Nixon, I was 13 years old, to go see Nixon that night. So I saw those three movies in one day.
I thought I didn't have one. You just made me think of one. And I have so many Dardan Brothers notes. But, you know, I'll dive into this for a second.
Shocking.
Mine was Good Night and Good Luck, followed by Big Mama's House 2.
Whoa.
And I can tell you, I'll tell you why, because so I was seeing I was in like middle school, I think. And I was seeing a girl at the time, and we just wanted to get dropped off at the movies to buy a ticket to any movie to be in the back row of the movie theater. But I made the mistake of picking a movie that I actually wanted to see and mentioning to my father, who was going to drop us off, oh, we want to go see Good Night and Good Luck. Sure. To which my dad went, well, I love Edward R. Murrow. I'll go see that.
That is the most Vic Natale fucking story I've ever heard.
Big Vic energy
right there.
So we all just sat reverently and watched Good Night and Good Luck. And then he was like, oh, you guys want to hang out in the shopping center? He's like, all right, just give me a call when you want to, you know, get picked up or whatever. So then she and I are scrambling like, all right, we got to find whatever is playing next. And that happened to be Big Mama's House 2. Mind you, I had not seen Big Mama's House 1. Had no context what we're going into.
Sounds like you didn't watch
Big Mama's in the mythology.
That is a weird movie to suck face to.
It's a weird movie to do anything to.
So, speaking of weird things.
Yeah, let's talk Rosetta for 10 minutes.
Wait, Phil, the rest of us gave ours. What's yours?
Oh, I genuinely don't know. I don't generally do double bills. So, off the dome, I don't have one.
All right. Well, you at least then at this point have to say what movie you snuck into as a rambunctious teen in the back row. I mean, what's the weirdest movie you ever snuck into and, you know, back row? That's the big question.
I mean, here's the thing. I don't know if our listeners know this. I'm Canadian. So in Canada, you can't see R-rated films. Like, you just straight up see them. Full stop. It's not like with a parent. You can't see them. So there's a lot of R-rated films that I snuck into when I was not, you know, 18 yet. I snuck into Alien Resurrection, for instance. I snuck into Pulp Fiction several times. Like, it's just, so it's the sneaking in component for me. That's where my brain goes towards just like movie. Like, I had to sneak in to see Ransom. Like, Ransom got an R-rating. Good movie. So it was one of those things where like my whole metrics are all kind of fucked because you guys could just go and see rated R movies with like older siblings and shit. So, you know,
my friend Sam, last thing I saw Scream 2. I saw both Screams in New York City where, you know, I'm not from New York City, where I presumed it was easier to sneak in, and it kind of was. Scream 2, what came out in 97, right? 96, 97, something like that.
97.
I was 15 years old. My friend Sam was very tall, but not particularly old looking. And we were able to get in with Sam telling the guy that I was his son. And it worked.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So the weird piece of trivia that I was going to tell our listeners is that Emily, the lead actress of this film, won the CFC Award for Most Promising Actress from the Chicago Film Critics Association, but she tied with Julia Stiles from 10 Things I Hate About You, which I think is unbelievable.
She tied at Cannes too. Not with Julia Stiles, but she tied at Cannes with Severine Cannell from La Humanité. So
everyone knows that.
Well, La Humanité was like the one they wanted to, that got best actor too, and maybe got director. Like, it kind of felt like they split the difference there at Cannes that year.
Mike just walked into a podcast that's just going to like shove him into a locker.
It really, like, for a minute after, look, I love this show and I'm so grateful to have been on this show so many times. But let's remember, like, I've done Pokemon, I've done Wolverine, I've done Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. When you're like, hey, let's, why don't you come on and do the Palme d'Or winner? I'm like, now it's Mike's time to shine. Now I can bring my cinephile bona fides, and I get in here and it's the just frat like, house energy. The frat house frat energy house of like energy. I don't know, Belgian whatever. Hey,
All right. Let's hand the podcast over to you, okay?
No, I don't need.
All right, all right, Richard Corliss or whoever you are. Let's
hand it over to Mike. I need a good nap.
Let's leave the discussion of Rosetta, Mike. You go right ahead. You get what do you want to talk about?
I do think that this film, I mean, again, because this was one that struck me when I, because I went back, they won the Palme d'Or twice, the Darden brothers. In 99, they win it for Rosetta. They win it again in 2005 for L'Enfant, or The Child. An interesting thing to me, I saw Two Days, One Night, right? Which I was so struck by when I saw it. It was my first Darden brothers movie, and I think everybody was struck by it. And then I went back and watched Rosetta, and my esteem for Two Days, One Night maybe dropped a bit, because I think if whenever, whatever your first Darden brothers movie is, if you consider like everything from Le Promesse on, because Le Promesse is what they consider their first official film, mostly because their first film is a weird movie about the Holocaust that's really bad, so they just pretend they didn't do that. Cool. There's the Darden brothers are this weird thing where it's like you watch their movies and you go, these guys tend to only make movies about white poor Belgians. And then you watch any time they try and do anything else and go, stick to the white poor Belgians. They had a movie, the only movie of theirs I've never finished, Young Ahmed, where they're like, you really, do you want to see our
you
take?
You really are a Darden head. Oh.
I've seen a fair number of their films. I mean, the reason it is partly is from the outset, I shouldn't like their movies, right? I don't love, air quotes, neo-realist films, and I really don't like movies that err on the side of poverty porn. And I think that the Dardans do manage to walk this incredible tightrope where, like, I should not like these movies on the surface, but they balance it so well because, especially Rosetta, it doesn't get talked about much, you guys are right, but when it does get talked about, I do get a little frustrated that I feel like a lot of times it gets reduced to the terms neo-realist and about poverty. This movie is not about poverty. That happens to be its setting, as the Darden films tend to be. I mean, L'Enfant, which is my favorite of theirs, if anybody hasn't seen it, I was telling Tom, it's a wild-ass movie because for 10 minutes, it's just kind of, you know, neo-realist, like, this guy's broke and he's trying to take care of his girlfriend and the baby they had together. And then 10 minutes in, he shows up to the girlfriend and goes, I sold our baby. We've got money now. And the rest of the movie is dealing with that. And I remember seeing it for the first time and just kind of feeling like, holy shit. Obviously,
sell a baby.
Well, that's the whole thing. Yeah, he just sells the baby.
Sure.
Yeah. but with Rosetta, I think with Rosetta, what I find so compelling about it is that it's not about poverty. Poverty is the setting, but it is a character study. It many people who talk about it and they just pretend that the whole movie is about, like, well, you know, if only she had money. This is really about class, but it's not. You know, Ebert calls it out where he talks about that. What is the term he uses? Economic determinism, right?
Yeah.
And in the Criterion, the booklet is written by Kent Jones, who, for folks who saw Diane, that was his debut feature a couple of years ago. He says it's a film about mania, about this magical idea fixe maintained by a girl who blots out anything and anybody standing in the way of its enactment. I think that what makes Rosetta so compelling to me anyway is that and this goes to what Tom said in his letterbox in a way, which is Rosetta's kind of an asshole. And I mean this in a good,
She's straight up an asshole.
And that's the thing. It's the same way that a movie that recently won Best Picture at the Oscars, Nomadland, if you think Nomadland works, which, you know, I have my mixed feelings on that film, but if you think it works because Fern is complicated. Mm-hmm. That the movie works because people who viewed Nomadland, and we saw people who praised that movie and talked about it just about, like, poverty or living on the outside. When that movie is really, when it's working, that movie is about watching a person realize the effects of their own selfishness or closed offness. That is a person who got so swept up in their idea of there's no way out for me unless I do it myself, and ultimately realizing there were opportunities along the way to get out. I think what makes this film so compelling to me, why I like Rosetta so much, whereas Tom can attest, there are so many movies that have this same kind of vibe that I just find exhausting. Mm-hmm. Why this one really works for me is it is not a movie about poverty. It is a movie about achieving some degree of self-awareness and outside of one's circumstances and recognizing one's own agency toward making a change. And I think that's what makes this so engaging.
I see all of that. And I don't,
I mean, I don't disagree with anything you're saying. I guess it's just, you know, I had to watch this in two sittings just based on my schedule. So, you know, that might not have done the film any favors, but you know, it's I had a real tough time with the cinematography, if I'm being honest. It gave me a bit of a headache. It's all like super fucking shaky and close up.
That's everything.
Yeah. Well, cool. It's just not my bag, and I found it distracting and a little annoying. But I appreciate how much time they want to spend on her face, in her headspace, all of that. I think it's effective in that regard. The real asshole of this movie, as far as I'm concerned, is the mom.
Sure.
The mom is that's a tough character. It's just I found the movie. I agree with you, Tom, that it's easy to be reductive about a movie like this, especially a foreign film that is, you know, about hardship and all the like. This movie, for all intents and purposes, I imagine, is what a lot of people in North America think when you say a foreign film, right? Like a film that is downtrodden and brutal and all of that. I do love that this film embraces the Belgian waffle in ways that, you know, when she's eating a waffle, I literally wrote, is that a Belgian waffle? And then literally the movie becomes about Belgian waffles, which that's awesome.
Listen, it's a good,
I love a waffle. Yeah. Waffles are good. I appreciate that this manic energy that the movie immediately starts in with her getting fired and having like throwing a fit and literally having to be dragged out of the premises.
Tom, did you get the excerpt I sent you from the Criterion essay?
Yeah.
I text you that Kent Jones. Okay, fine. I thought you would find it. Kent Jones, when describing Phil, when describing what you're describing, the manic energy. The manic energy of it, Kent Jones draws the comparison where he goes, you know, it feels like something out of The Bourne Ultimatum or Old Boy. And I'm like,
no,
I never in a million years would I have drawn those lines.
I don't think I would have done that either.
I was going to make the joke about when Phil said he was getting sick from the shaky cam, that they're the Paul Greengrass of neorealism movies. It's just like, this would be cool if I could watch your fucking movie, guys.
It made me think more of fucking Cloverfield, where I literally almost threw up in the theater.
Dude, I would have lost my shit if at the end of the movie she's about to kill herself and a fucking Cloverfield happens.
I did think about doing the meme is dead, but you remember that meme that was going around of what if Michael Bay directs it? And, you know, what if Michael Bay directed what? If we just panned up to Rosetta's face, she stops crying, looks serious, and just starts playing Linkin Park. You know, what if we...
Because there's a whole running thing in this movie that her stomach hurts and she keeps like keeling over in pain.
Yeah,
period
cramps is what she's suffering from.
But yeah.
Whatever. I wasn't paying attention. I was, but also like,
this is my Thomas Crown Affair episode. That's what this is.
That kept wanting a prestige movie,
motherfucker. Here we go. All right.
They kept focusing on it as if it was going to be like something that pays off at the end. Wouldn't it be fucking hilarious if it ends like Titan and she just gives birth to a car?
Can I confess one thing of my own ignorance here for a minute?
Sure.
On this?
Just one.
Yeah.
So I watched this in 2014, right? You know, this was about a little less than a decade ago. You know that thing, and I'm just going to own this. You know that thing that we all deal with as guys, which is like, we don't necessarily have the best understanding of some of the struggles and difficulties that the women in our lives go through, right?
Specifically menstruation.
Don't
let me in there. I'm an ally. Fuck you.
Okay. but you know that thing where like shit like that's going on and you feel like you want to, you know, you wish you could be helpful.
Yeah.
You can't. So I had her with the hair dryer has stuck in my mind for so long. It's a great image in that opening scene with the hairdryer. But there is this thing where my stupid brain, anytime someone in my life has complained about cramps, where like I remember that scene and my brain wants to go, well, have you tried a hairdryer? As though to say, like, number one, the terrible idea. That movie is going out of its way to say it's a bad idea. But number two, if it were a practical solution, surely she would have thought of this before I correct. Came up with it. And yet every time there's that part of my brain that thinks like, this is my Slumdog Millionaire moment where I'm like, there was a thing I experienced before that can help me now. That's like, amazing. You know, I don't know. But
I do think that,
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's almost a little bit too much to some degree. I'm not suggesting that that menstruation cramps aren't a very real thing. They are, but it does kind of feel at times where it's like you're giving Rosetta so many hardships that it does feel a little bit like poverty porn at times. I mean, when I you know, at every turn, it feels as though she's grappling with some of the thing. Now, I'm not suggesting that your thesis statement earlier, Mike, isn't true, which is I do think it's about self-actualization to some degree or another. It's about her taking control of her life. And depending on how you interpret the end of this film, perhaps she goes on to live something close to a happy life. I don't know that that seems plausible, but it's certainly possible.
I think it's not so much about even her taking control of her life so much as her being willing to surrender it a bit in sure. terms of sure. one of the things that's great. You mentioned, the real villain of this film is Rosetta's mom. But I think that the important thing about her mother in this film is the fact that, you know, and this is something I deal with a lot. And I think we all have to deal with as we get older is we have to actually know. This is something Tom and I talk about constantly just in general in life, is like actually knowing who you are versus your idea of who you are.
Sure.
You know, and it's little things like we know so many people. I mean, look, we're all writers to one degree, you know, in one capacity or another. Right. Mm-hmm. We all tell ourselves things of if I just blank, if I had A, B and C, that's what I need to motivate me to blank. And we've all learned that 90% of those things we tell ourselves aren't actually true. That like times where we sit down and go, what I actually need. And people struggle with that. The thing that I love about the parallels in this film, in a way,
yep.
is that Rosetta's mother, we all recognize Rosetta's mother is bad because her mom is sleeping around with guys, taking money for, you know, who knows what. She's drunk. Anytime Rosetta tries to question this and like go to her and be like, mom, knock it off. Her mom is very just kind of like her whole vibe is fuck you. You can't tell me what to do. I'm doing what I got to do to get by. I know what I need. I know what I got to do. And which is what motivates, quite frankly, so many people who are, whether they're addicts or any other kind of struggle, is this like, fuck you. You don't know me like I know me.
Right.
And what I think is so great is that by the end, rather than treat Rosetta as a parallel where like she's drugging and drinking like her mom, the thing that Rosetta realizes is
we both need to die.
No, what she realizes is
I say right, so, but
I have hurt. Like she fucks the guy out of the
but her and her mother. I mean,
before the suicide, I'm talking okay, about. Okay. I'm saying like the revelation that she kind of has is even though I have told myself I'm not like my mom because I don't drink like she does and I don't sleep around like she does. The monster inside of me, the thing, the part of my personality that makes me do things like screw the only person that ever tried to help me out of a job is the same kind of, I got to get mine. Fuck you. I'm going to do what I need to do. And don't you tell me what I need because only I know what I need and only I can look out for myself. One of the struggles that I think, one of the things that I find so universal about this film and that element of Rosetta is so many people, I think, who have any kind of issue where they look at a parent and say, I don't want to become that.
Sure.
Focus on external things and focus on kind of like, well, I don't want to be like my dad. And he was an accountant, so I'm going to become a fucking, you know, playwright or whatever. But they don't actually
like
focus
my literal story, Mike.
Well, this is what I'm like, but I'm, you know, this is, you've talked about it on the show before, though, Kenny, about this idea of like having to recognize in yourself, like, it's not about the external things and it's not about like individual decisions. It's about like what motivates you and how you approach things. And I think that Rosetta's journey in this film is her recognizing like, it's my approach to things rather than my actual actions.
I gotta say though, like it is like the way this movie handles the mother is actually it's kind of fucking funny. Like maybe they're not meaning it to be funny. Maybe it's like an execution issue, but it's literally just like it almost feels like a joke I have Halloween Ends on, so I'm gonna say like in a fucking Danny McBride show or something where like anytime Rosetta turns around and then she turns back around, it's like, oh god, she's sucking another dick.
It's like, definitely
if she takes her eyes off her, she's going to disappear and be like in a gas station sucking dicks for a can of soda. Her mom fucks for money. Like she doesn't have to do it every time she turns around.
It feels like it's a mixture of that and Weekend at Bernie's, because it feels like when she's like dragging her around, it's like I know that it's not meant for jokes, but I do agree with you, Tom, that there's a part of me that's like, the character is so far gone that it's teetering into a place of like absurdity a little bit.
That's what you get for taking this seriously, Mike.
It's kind of what you get. It's kind of what you were saying though about how like they keep hammering the so much stuff throughout the movie. Yeah. Like I kind of made like the period stuff, they were focusing on it so much. At first didn't think it was like period issues. So I'm like, this feels like it's going to build to something where it's like, oh, she's got like stomach cancer or something that she's poor, can't get it. Well, listen, that woman never fucks. That's one thing. She's never going to fuck.
She's 17, just for the record, but yes.
She's 17. This guy's talking about taking a girl to Big Mama's house too to play some fucking fingery color. Like, come on.
All right. But now Michael took us way off the rails by taking this movie seriously. I mean, come on, man. This movie's for me at least personally, I think this boils down to like one major thing, which is I just had a hard time hooking in. I don't disagree with anything you say. I appreciate how I appreciate how you engage with this film. I just had a hard time hooking in. And a lot of it is, it's almost Dogma 95 in this way. There's no score throughout the entire film. Yep. It's all handheld. It's very shaky. It's essentially four characters in the entire movie. It's very bleak. And it's hard for me as a, you know, as a like a Disney boy or whatever I am to
Rosetta's mom sucking another dick off.
Engage with a that's a, the you know a 95 minute Belgian film.
I know.
Essentially about how hard it is to get a job when you're poor. And it's also, and I know this is like a really lame way to put it, but like nothing about this is novel. Like everything you just said to me, you know, we've talked about these themes and these ideas. I don't want to say ad nauseum, but ad nauseum, because those are some of the central themes of narrative entertainment, of narrative, period, full stop. So if it works for you, that's great. It did not work for me. It just is not something, it's not something that I was able to kind of, you know, get up inside of like Mike at Big Mama's.
I'm joking around and I'm listen, Mike just likes watching movies about women that are possessed by the dick demon. It's fine. I'm joking around and on all the shit. I did really like this movie. I found
in you gave it 4.5 stars, bro. But I thought you loved it.
I've kind of come to really appreciate these neorealist like very like almost where nothing happens kind of movies, you know. I said I have Halloween Ends on right now, so I'm a big David Gordon Green fan.
Don't give away too much.
I'm not gonna say shit because Mike hasn't seen it either, and I want him to be as free as possible.
I've only had one thing spoiled to me. So
I think George Washington is great. I think all the real girls.
Oh,
is
I love
great.
George Washington.
I mean, I think he's yeah. I'm 100%.
I love early David Gordon Green. It's I don't know. I mean, there are a lot of barriers for this movie for me in particular, and I just wasn't able to knock him down.
But that's what I'm trying to say is like, you know, I've come to like those kind of movies and Cassavetes stuff, which is this is definitely working within the Cassavetes realm and everything. But it's like, I think that like the big difference between like a this and a George Washington, in my opinion, or the Cassavetes stuff is the thing we're kind of saying. It's kind of just hitting the same beat the entire movie. And there's no real, they're not really changing the notes at all. There's no, it's kind of like listening to what's the fucking asshole song the Beatles did? Nine, that annoying song. It's like
number nine.
It doesn't hate Jude. They're playing Hey Nine, Revolution Nine, which is just like, fuck. Okay, like I get it. Jesus Christ, I get it. It's like we know what you're doing, but all right, relax.
I mean, there's a couple things I would like to just hit because there are some things that I did quite like about this film, and I'm you know my rating is pretty high, all things considered, but. I did really like when Rosetta goes to live with Riquet, and they're sort of like him doing gymnastics for her and her chugging that beer and like that awkward dance scene as he plays sort of music that's you can't really dance to. Like that was a real, like, I enjoyed that because it felt like it kind of broke out of, as you were saying, sort of the monotony of her life. The heartbreaking scene of her talking to herself before she goes to bed, where she says, "Your name is Rosetta. My name is Rosetta. You found a job. I found a job. You've got a friend. I've got a friend. You have a normal life. You will not be left wayside. Good night. Good night." It is a brutal, amazing, wonderful scene. And like that to me encapsulates the whole film. There's just a real sort of like lovely nuance to it. It kind of lets you sit in a moment rather than like shaking the fucking camera while she like, you know, runs away from Riquet or whatever the case might be. You know, the scene of her when she's fired by her boss because he hires his deadbeat son, basically, and she's screaming about how she wants a normal life and clutching a bag of flour on the ground. Like, it's just...
yeah.
There is a lot of good shit. Surprisingly for me, the middle of this movie works the best, because like the beginning, I was just sort of like, oh, so this is just terrible. And then at least there's some variations of what's going on in the middle, just like things kind of get weird, which I kind of appreciate. And then I just personally speaking, like it feels honestly like foreign film Mad Libs at times, where it's like at the end when like she's gonna kill herself and her mother, it's just like it really just felt like too much for me. So it kind of tips, but then I really appreciated the very last scene. So I mean
to touch on a couple things, I mean, one of the things that I really do appreciate about the Jordan brothers and a lot of their work is we keep saying neorealist, right? And well, I mean, no, other Tom mentioned neorealism.
I'm kidding. I think that
when it comes to the neorealist movement, I mean, that's a much broader term than a lot of people want to recognize. Like, our idea of neorealist now, and when we talk about neorealist movies and when people try and make a neorealist movie, most times they're emulating the early Italian neorealists, you know, Vittorio De Sica and people of that, Roberto Rossellini, right? Bicycle Thieves, Rome Open City, all of that, right? Tom and I have gone back and forth on Bicycle Thieves probably since college. He's a bigger fan of that film than I am. When you look at the neorealist movement, Fellini comes.
I love Sad Guineas. What can I say?
Fellini comes along. And if anybody knows, there's a writer named Peter Bonadella who wrote a book on the history of Italian cinema. And he implied that what Fellini does when Fellini comes into the film scene, because neorealism was just the only thing you could really do in Italy at the time. And when Fellini comes in, he starts to treat neorealism as Bonadella puts it, he says it's more of a moral position than a cinematic movement. And by that, I mean, when you look at Fellini's films, especially when you get from Ivy Deloni onward, and especially Knights of Cabiria, which this film borrows a lot from, Knights of Cabiria is not neorealist in the traditional structural sense. Kenny evoked the Dogme movement before and like their rigid rules. Knights of Cabiria is certainly not that. The fourth wall is broken at points in Knights of Cabiria. There's that incredible shot when she's standing under the street lamp and it's very artificially like only lighting her. There's a lot of symbolism in that. I think one of the things that I really like about the Dardin brothers is that so many people who make neorealist films are basically just treating it as nothing in this movie can feel structured. There can be no symbolism. There can be nothing. We are just going to shoot it as it would really happen. It's easy to watch Rosetta, I think, the first time and see it that way. Mm-hmm. And to just see it as like, we're just pointing and shooting. But the Dardans are very deliberate about what they show and also what they don't show. I mean, that's a quote when their previous film, which is follows a young boy played by Jeremy Renier. That's his real name is Jeremy Renner, but with a French accent. He's a young boy whose father, who shows up in this film, the guy who owns the waffle stand in this, Olivier Gourmet, has worked with the Dardans like four times. In Le Promesse, he plays a guy, Jeremy Renier's father, who exploits immigrant labor. And Jeremy Renier kind of discovers these people's humanity and pushes back against his dad. He appears again as the boss. But let's say, you know, when they were working on that and they asked Jean-Pierre what their approaches, he said it was really a matter of figuring out to know what you're going in order to film what you want to show of a face or a body, you have to first decide what you want to hide. There is a deliberateness to what they show. And to bring it to what Phil was saying about the bed scene, which is a great, you know, probably the best scene of the film when she's sitting in the bed. For the rest of this movie, Phil's right. The camera's shaking. We're following her around. There's momentum. Rosetta is always moving. She's always, 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 always moving. And at the same time, Rosetta never takes the moment to actually consider her own doubt, to consider herself or have any perspective. The only time you see her go through that moment of giving herself affirmations, that moment of doubt, what is she doing? She is literally up against a wall. That's not something that you do if you are entirely about just absolute realism. Like, there is a structured and staging kind of thing to this, the same way that, oh, sorry, yeah.
I don't mean to suggest that there isn't a tremendous amount of intent in this film. I mean, there obviously is. I think that this film is filled with emotion and intellectualism and any number of things. I'm just with Kenny to a certain degree, which is that it's a bit of a struggle to lock into this character. This is something that, you know, Kenny and I have sort of talked about this a little bit because we've covered a handful of foreign films between the three podcasts. And, you know, I think that a lot of people, unfortunately, in this country, look at foreign films as homework. They feel challenging. You have to, quote unquote, read them. There's just a lot there. Now, I think that this country's gotten a lot better recently, which I think is great. I think that, you know, obviously looking at the success of Parasite, looking at sort of what Neon is doing in general, and a lot of these companies are really sort of finding really interesting foreign films. But this film is determined to keep you at arm's length. It's determined to keep you sort of at odds with Rosetta's character. And that makes for a challenging experience. That's not to say it's a bad movie. It's not, certainly not a movie that I would watch again. I understand why there are people that love this film genuinely. And I certainly didn't hate it by any means. And I don't think Kenny or Tom hated it either. I just think that, I think it's perhaps deceptively simple to some degree. Plot wise, not a lot happens. You know, the biggest revelation in the film is when she essentially fucks over Riquet and you know, confesses to her boss that he's essentially ripping him off. I want to ask a question to everybody, obviously, but the end of this film is ambiguous. Obviously, this movie just kind of holds on a moment. Rosetta cries, perhaps like actually visibly sobs for the first time in the film, as she's lugging this can of gasoline back to the house to potentially, you know, commit suicide with her mother. And Riquet is sort of circling her on his moped. And we have this moment where perhaps for the first time, she really looks him in the eye and they sort of have this real perhaps connection. Then we smash to black. Was this ending hopeful for you guys? Was this ending tragic for you guys? How did you feel? What was your takeaway from the ending of the film, considering how sort of ambiguous it is? Kenny?
You fellas go first. I'll.
Was the ending hopeful or tragic? I don't think you can leave.
It doesn't need to be one of those options.
Yeah, no, I don't think you can leave this movie feeling hopeful. Yeah. I think this very much is just pointing towards a, you know, cycle of misery.
Sure.
Occasionally punctuated by moments of non-misery. So no, I didn't take any hope away from this. Is my answer.
I didn't take any hope away from it either. I wouldn't even say it's tragic either, because she's so fucking unlikable. I'm truly jumping for joy that the rest of her life is going to be filled with misery.
Yeah.
She's a fucking it. Honestly, the scene where she throws Rickey under the bus, I'm like, oh wow. Like, if this was like a more mate, like I thought he was going to like kill her at the end. And I would have been like,
what about when she doesn't? What about when she hesitates to save him when he falls into the?
All right. Yes. She's a psychopath. Okay.
I was more annoyed when she wouldn't get paid under the table.
Yeah.
I'm like, standards. Come the fuck on.
If she was a white guy, the end of the movie would be her shooting up a cafe. That's how much of a psychopath she is. I didn't tell Mike what I was going to say, but my opinion of her is, if she was an American woman, she'd be a MAGA person. She's got so much self-loathing for herself and for poor people, but she's like, I'm not like these poor people. I work hard. Look at my mom just sucking dick and drinking all day and doing drugs. All these poor people, they don't get it. I'll throw people under the bus. I'm not like everybody else. I'm going to be successful. I don't care who I got to throw under the bus or let drown for some reason. She would 100% vote for Trump and also probably have some similarities and views with Kanye. I'll just put it at that.
Oh, they all do.
Mike? So,
hopeful.
Rosetta is, well, I don't know if it's hopeful, but
the,
I feel
the end of the film.
Rosetta is very, the whole film, but I'm saying is very indebted to Fellini's Knights of Cabiria. I think there's one scene that's a direct parallel. If anybody has seen Knights of Cabiria, and what happens in Knights of Cabiria, when we first see her, she's knocked into the, she trusted and loved a man, she was relying on this man, he takes her money, he shoves her in the water, right?
Correct.
In Rosetta is also knocked in the water and abandoned, but not by a man, by her mother, right? Correct. That, and so much of this has that Knights of Cabiria energy. And of course the ending of Knights of Cabiria is her crying, she's feeling depressed, and then in Knights of Cabiria, the actual Knights of Cabiria, it's church people singing a religious song, and obviously if you watch Sweet Charity, it's a group of hippies that give her a flower and all of that. And in
or
this,
the end of Magnolia.
Yes. And in this, it's Rickey. And I think that, to me, it's more the fact that she's been on this journey this whole film. And you're right, you mentioned like she doesn't try, you know, she hesitates to save him. Why? Because what she's been conditioned by her mother and by society, nobody tried to save her when she went into the river either, right? And there's a recognition of, I think her relationship with Rickey is that he'll try and save her, but when he does, she sees that as, number one, an act of weakness from him, and number two, accepting help from him means owing somebody something or being indebted. I think at the end, there's something powerful about the parallel between when he first comes to her on his motorcycle, his whirring, you know, kind of this almost like being chased by a bee kind of sound whirring motorcycle. When he first comes to her and he's telling her to, you know, get a job, whatever, he's pinning her to the ground the first time we see, you know, she's getting pinned to the ground. Uh-huh. This time, while that's not happening physically, there is an emotional moment of like, for the first time, you know, there's an intervention.
Do you see this ending as hopeful?
I'm getting there. Okay. I'm sorry. I'm not talking about her shooting up a cafe, but I'm getting to a point gang.
Listen, that was a good point.
I think that in that moment, it's not a matter. I can't put it as hopeful or depressing because it's not a matter of like that she is going to have a better life.
Right.
Or that she's going to have a terrible life.
Okay.
That moment to me is not about her future. That is not about where she's going. This is one of those movies where quite frankly, Rosetta ceases to exist as soon as the credits roll. But in that moment, it is a moment of surrender. Okay. It is a moment of,
I like that.
Of this whole movie. She is fighting, even when he's physically pinning her down at one point. She's fighting against a river. She's fighting against everything. And in that moment, it is just like how, in a way, Knights of Cabiria is this character finally just kind of accepting her place in the parade.
Sure.
But there's a parade coming and she walks with it. There's no parade in here, but in that final moment, or like 400 blows or anything like that final moment of just the character hits that revelation and surrenders. So I don't think it's hopeful. I don't think it's ending. It's just a moment of finally, after fighting for 90 minutes, fighting against the world, she either accepts help or accepts life. It's just a moment of acceptance.
I like that. Let's rate this film, because perhaps most importantly, you two gentlemen are going to do your top 10 lists of 1999. And we're very excited. I am very excited to hear what you guys...
Literally can't wait.
So I didn't see this film in 99, as we've all sort of said. Coming into this podcast, I was at an 85. I was pretty high. But I have to say that this
based is, on what?
Based on genuinely, I thought that I think she's a really interesting character. I do think that Rosetta is a complicated, messy, fucked up, challenging character. And that's really interesting to me. I hate the fucking cinematography, but and I've come down. I mean, I'm at a 77. I think that it's I part of my issues with this film have less to do with what it's saying and more to do with just how unfortunately unpleasant it is. And I do have to grapple with the idea, and as we've been doing this podcast, of the idea of a movie being an enjoyable experience or not, and whether or not that's indicative of it being good or bad. And I think that this film might not have been an enjoyable experience by, you know, any stretch of the imagination, but I still think that it's a great film. I still think it's doing a lot of really interesting things, even if it's a film that I don't ever want to watch again. That's just, you know, obviously personal choice. But all right, Tom, what about you?
Didn't see it in 99. Wasn't at the top of my list as a 9-year-old. I came into this podcast, I'd say 85, which, you know, I rounded up to a 4.5 on Letterboxd, as they hinted at earlier in the episode. I'm at the same, you know. And it wasn't my goal to make any of you make Phil or Kenny like this movie any less, but I'm kind of happy that I helped make Phil like this movie just a little bit less. That's a little point of pride in my mind.
You're still in an 85?
Yeah. Because Mike's the only one that could make a case for me for saying it's better, and I never listen to this fucking guy about anything, so I'm at an 85.
I'm gonna give it a rating that actually reflects the way I talked about this film on the podcast, as opposed to you two who are giving it a rating
on this movie.
I like the movie. I like the sense of place.
Do you think they talked about this movie like they liked this movie?
I think Phil talked about it relatively positively, but it was also trying to keep the show going, keep a discussion going. And okay. Tom did that thing that Tom does, which is he can like 95% of a movie, but if there's a 5% of it that really sticks in his craw, he's going to keep coming back to that 5%, the same way on our Gone with the Wind episode for 2.5 hours. He kept going, and back to this one scene. Like, it just so
I did.
That. I get the
okay.
Time.
Well, yes. I'll leave that to the. I'll leave this to the listener.
But like, I like the sense of place and the sense of the environment. I joke around. I do think she is an interesting character. I'm used to, and I like watching movies about horrible people. I don't need a movie to be someone that holds my hand and makes me feel good about myself, a likable person. You know, I'm not like Kenny, a Disney boy. Mm-hmm. I like Sam Peckinpah movies. I like watching movies with, you know, terrible fucking people getting their comeuppance, or even like just this. She's kind of a piece of shit, but I get why she's a piece of shit. And while I think it's not a perfect movie by any stretch, I've made my jokes, but I do think, like me and Phil were saying, I do think it hits one note way too often, and if there was more variances in the realistic narrative it's laying out, like that middle section, like the scene with her going to bed and everything, like her having like that little date sort of thing with Rickey, I think the movie would have greatly benefited. And I think that ending where Rickey comes and she looks and maybe she doesn't kill herself or maybe she does, either way, she has her moment of self-actualization, I think the movie would have been even better, in my opinion. But I do really like
in the 90s. All right, I get it.
But I so like, that's why I say it's an 85. I like this kind of movie. I think this movie is a good example of that kind of movie. But I do think they're young filmmakers, and I think they've made some issues that young filmmakers working in this world kind of make, which is why I think, you know, Good Time and Uncut Gems are better than the Safdie's earlier movies. They learned and they got better and they know what they're doing now. So, I don't know.
All right,
Kenny, let's
hear I'm not happy that I didn't like a Palme d'Or winner. I'm not happy that I don't like David Sims's fourth best movie of the year. I'm not happy that I feel like an uncultured boob, but like, guys, this is not an enjoyable film. And the only person on this podcast who made the case for it is Mike. So I don't know what universe I'm living in. You can shake your head, but we can listen back to the podcast. Nothing but negatives the entire time.
Eddie, okay. I took four specific instances in my notes that I talked about scenes that I liked. I specifically talked about like all sorts of things that I liked about
the film. There weren't just four scenes in the movie. Okay. But in 85? Okay.
Kenny.
I'm
at right now.
This is the
guys,
beauty of
cinema. Guys, this is my moment. This is my moment. I didn't talk during your moments. My moment. I gave it a 57 before the podcast, almost entirely because I didn't want to go below 50 for a movie that I respect. I am going below 50 now because I don't enjoy this film. If you're watching a film and you're incredibly bored and you can't lock in and you don't, you have to read the fucking Wikipedia summary to understand what's happening in the film, which, by the way, I have a feeling other people on this podcast did, because there are things that are only in the Wikipedia summary that aren't in the film. Okay. I'm giving it a fucking 40. I'm sorry. This is not a movie for me. And I'm going to be fucking real here. It's just not for me. Kenny is giving it a 40. That doesn't mean it's a 40 in the world. It means I'm giving it a 40. Okay.
Did My Favorite Martian beat this?
I'll look it up while you,
Kenny,
give your 98.
There are definitely movies that you hate a lot more than this that you gave better ratings.
I've never given a movie I hate above a 40 ever.
For Kenny's whole thing, we're talking about the negatives. This is the beauty of cinema, right? A movie can be greater than the sum of its parts. All right, we were taking the piss out of it. For me personally, it was kind of just to get some reactions out of Mike. That's kind of what my whole thing. I love making Mike pull out a flask and drink.
Tom doesn't get to be mean about movies on our show. So when he's on someone else's,
you guys can say whatever you want about whatever movie you want. This is an opinion-based podcast. I don't mind if you want to talk for, you know, 90 minutes about all the negatives of a movie you loved. When I love a movie, I talk about the positives like Mike Natale did.
I didn't love the movie. Mike's going to give
85
you
is good. I guess we disagree.
That's a B plus.
Your 85 is a B plus. So it's a little different. You only go down to 60. But
yeah,
I know.
I grade like I'm in school.
I know. That's, it's a little different.
All right. Let's move on to your top 10.
No, Mike's.
Oh, sorry, Mike. You got to go. Sorry, Mike.
Somebody has to give
the only
this
positivity into this episode.
So when I saw it.
Yes, that's right. The only positivity.
When I saw it the first time, I'd only seen 2 days, one night prior to this. And I think I gave it about an 80. I think part of it was, as I've watched more of their films, especially L'Enfant, but Le Promise, which is the film they make before this, I came to kind of figure out what's going on in their language and that there's more to them than just the realism and all of that. So since then, watching it again in prep for this podcast,
sure,
much like Phil and Tom, I was at an 85. I spent the past 90 minutes, like Rosetta spends her 90 minutes, struggling against a system contrived to push back and to valiantly try and achieve my goal, when every step of the way somebody's going, hang on, let's talk about waffles. So,
dude, after there's a lot of fucking waffles in this movie. It deserves to be talked about.
And much like Rosetta, somebody behind Mike is sucking a dick.
No, much like Rosetta, by the end of this, I really thought about getting a can of gas and just, which, by the way, I didn't even get to talk about what a good cough gas joke that is. But we're whatever. Lord. Point is, after this podcast, fuck you guys. I'm giving it a 90. Me and David Sim can go party at the Transit Museum while the rest of you guys
sit back and watch my favorite Martian. Fuck you guys. These guys love this movie. It's just fuck me, right? Fuck the only guy who actually dislikes this film. Not these guys who love this movie.
Such offense to this guy.
I'm not taking offense. I'm not taking offense. I don't like being gaslit. Mike and I live in this world where Mike did have to battle against the three of us all episode, and then I turn around and you two are both giving it fucking 85s. It's hilarious. I don't care.
I love the
I'm making I'm not offended. I'm making fun of you. There's a big difference.
No, you're taking it personally.
I don't give a shit.
We're talking about a Palme d'Or winner. If you can't talk about the things that aren't perfect about the movie and then at the end say, well, yeah, it's a good movie. It's a good movie. We talked about the good things.
That's great, guys.
Woman sucked the movie's dick the entire time for you, Kenny.
I gave my favorite Martian a 41, Michael. Let's
move on. All right. But also, wait. Before we get...
I mean, ridiculous.
Disney boy.
Before we get to the 99 top 10, I don't know. Mike can't hear me right now. I know I did. Mike, before we get to the 99 top 10, do you want to do... Because I did it. Did you make your top 10 Palme d'Or winners?
Oh, my. You did?
I've got a running ranking, Tom. If you give me a sec, I can look it up. I don't know if their audience will care. But
all right, so
I got 15 minutes on this. Then I got a
let's do your top 10s, guys.
Okay. Come on. Okay.
All right.
So let's go back and forth. We'll start at 10. We'll work our way. I like that Tom is lighting a cigarette. This is amazing.
Why not?
Mike, do you want to go first? What's your 10?
So my list is structured a little differently. I didn't know. I mean, like, only insofar as I really wanted to be conscious of, I don't know if it's necessarily like the objective top 10 movies, but I tried to think about this show and what it meant and also try and represent some things that maybe weren't covered on this show and so on and so forth. And number 10 is kind of emblematic of that. Because I think if I was just like doing raw scores based on numbers or anything, this wouldn't be my number 10. But it felt appropriate to put it at the bottom of this list for this. My number 10 is The Talented Mr. Ripley, because it is a movie and the first movie I've been listening to the show since the beginning. It is the first movie that you guys covered that I watched because of this podcast.
Interesting.
And I fell in love with. And it is one of my favorite films now. I don't know if it necessarily beats out some of the big names from 99 that didn't make my top 10, but just from a cyclical standpoint, it made a lot of sense to kind of cap all this off by talking about a movie that you guys made me watch because
Phil, by the way,
oh no,
do you have any idea what your Talented Mr. Ripley rating was?
It's not very high,
but do you know what it was?
I think it's in the 70s.
It's a 78.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
It's one of my
darkest moments that I thought I was too low. You 78.
This is the problem, which is that it was the third movie we did.
That's Rosetta territory.
It's higher than it's 1 point higher than Rosetta. I've said this. We were talking about it yesterday that like there's a couple early movies that I want to rewatch. I've obviously been very vocal about my love of Ripley, and it'll be much higher.
I'm shocked.
What's your 10, Tom?
My 10 is
I was an 81.
It's a Kenny movie. Any Given Sunday,
my man.
love Any Given Sunday. It is, in my opinion, the best football movie because it's the only one that kind of just goes to show what a degenerate, disgusting fucking business it is. And it's only aged even better. Two, 3 weeks after Tua Tagovailoa, I can't pronounce his fucking name, I'm sorry, but after Tua's brain leaked out of his fucking ears on national TV. It's an amazing movie. It's Oliver Stone's last great movie before the LSD finally destroyed his brain.
It is his last great movie.
And it's for as long as it is, it's wildly entertaining and it flies by. I think it's kind of a masterpiece, I think. So yeah, Any Given Sunday is my number 10.
You're not the first person to put it on their tens, which is
true.
At number 10, I think. Even though I don't know.
And that Al Pacino speech at the end, you know, that gets played a lot in my life of just before anything or when we play softball or whatever. It's just we gotta give that Al Pacino speech. So, you know. Any Given Sunday has hell of a life to it.
What's your nine, Mike?
So my number nine never got covered on this show. This is about a 60-40 split of 99 movies I wanted to get some love on this podcast that didn't get seen. But it did compete for the Palme d'Or opposite Rosetta. My number nine is a movie called Moloch by the Russian director Alexander Sukharov. If people know Sukharov, they probably know his movie Russian Ark that was very popular for being a one-take film. Moloch takes place at a Bavarian castle owned by Adolf Hitler. It's Hitler and Eva and Goebbels and his wife. And Sukharov's whole idea was to show kind of the banality of evil over this film by basically showing Hitler and his cohorts and his wife going, let's have a weekend where we don't talk politics.
Fucking great. I wish
it's worth checking out. It's a hell of a picture. And I just wanted to give it a bit of love.
Wow.
What's your nine, Tom?
A stone cold fucking masterpiece. It's one of a kind. Nothing else like it. I love it so much. I'm the guy wearing the horror movie shirt and I'm covered in horror movie tattoos. It's Audition. Yeah. Fucking love Audition. I mean, God, I want to find anybody I know that hasn't seen it or date somebody that's never seen it. Just be like, let's just watch Audition. Tell them nothing about it and just have them experience it blind. Cause that shift is like,
it's the best.
One of the best shifts, maybe the best shift from going from what you think the movie is to, oh, fuck, this is not what I thought this fucking movie was of all time. And I got to say, when she cuts his foot off and throws it at the door and it just goes flump. It's one of the funniest, blackest comedy moments of all time. Such a fucking good movie.
We actually, Kenny and I are working with two writers who had not seen Audition. So we were raving about that the other day. So hopefully they're.
Oh, my God.
Don't watch it.
Dude.
Mike, they'll love it.
What's your eight?
My number eight is, of course, one that everybody remembers this fabulous episode about it. I'm kidding. Le Petit Vendu du Soleil, or The Little Girl Who Sold the Sun. It's by Jibril Diop Mabedi, a Senegalese filmmaker. Most people probably know him from his film Tukibuki in 1973. Mabedi actually died in 1998. This was the last film he ever got to make. It's about 45 minutes long. It's about a young handicapped girl in Senegal who's trying to make money and becomes the first girl in that town who is allowed to sell newspapers. It's beautiful, it's evocative, and it shows his love for his people and his community. Some incredible scenes in that. If folks have Canopy, they can watch it there. But Mabedi's like final legacy as one of the great African filmmakers, despite not getting to make that many films in his lifetime, came out in 99. So I wanted to give a little love to.
Wow, Mike.
Betty.
Tom, what's your eight?
My eight. Surprising coming from me that an animated movie is on the list, but it's The Iron Giant. I love that fucking movie. It's perfect movie. It's you know, I'm Superman, you know, I mean, tears.
Does it get you? Does it tears every time?
Oh, tears. Every time he sacrifices himself at the end and he just goes Superman and oh my God. And
did you watch it as a younger man?
Not in 99, but once Cartoon Network started playing it all the fucking time, that was I watched it all the time. Me and my younger brother, we shared a room and we watched it all the goddamn time. And gotta give credit to Christopher McDonald is the actor who plays mm-hmm. Kent Mansley.
Goose McKenzie, yeah.
His David Sims jokes about it all the time, but when he gets in the car and goes, oh my God, it's one of the funniest fucking, it's Brad Bird's masterpiece. You know, I hate to say like the first movie is a guy's best movie, but I think it's his absolute masterpiece. I love it so much.
You know, for people who've listened to our episode, I think that Kenny and I both had not seen it you had not seen it, right? I think it just got built up too much for me, and it's been put. It was by so many people, and not just, but like, it's just you know what I'm talking about.
I was expecting something,
yeah,
different. I don't know how else to put it. I think
I don't know. I think I'm too old and jaded. I only really like one Brad Bird movie. So
I thought you were say I only really like one movie. That would have actually.
I only really like one Brad Bird. Which one do you think it is?
The Incredibles?
Not even like
Ratatouille.
Ratatouille.
Yeah.
I think Brad Bird.
I love Ratatouille.
I think Incredibles is bad. And I don't. I genuinely don't like intellectually understand why people are into it. I don't. It's one of those things, and this happens with a lot of Brad Bird movies, where I don't understand how the people who like it can like it despite its obvious fucking Randian politics. I don't get it. I don't understand how you can ignore it, and then how all these people who we love can write articles pretending that that it doesn't exist. Sorry, Ratatouille. On the other hand, love it. Brilliant, beautiful, fantastic.
Mike, what's your seven?
I know I've been kind of annoying you guys with some of these like off.
So keep it up.
It's not annoying me. I love it.
So number seven is The Dark Tower by Stan Brakhage. That's right. Stan Brakhage, who most people probably know from his non-narrative works from the 60s and 70s, like Dog Star Man and Mothlight. Well, he was still making films all the way to his death in 2004. The Dark Tower is a 3-minute long paint on celluloid film that depicts a single black line in the monk's color.
Being a parody.
Can I be real with you? Can I be honest? Look, I'm not even joking. When I did, because when I was trying to figure out this top 10, I went on my Letterboxd and I just decided like 99 sort by 5-star films. And when I saw like, right, Dark Tower's in there, like, fuck it, I'll put Dark Tower in there. Right. Like, I'll do it. Because honestly, it's more of
this is your list. You do what you want to do. You want to put a 3-minute paint on celluloid.
Here's the thing about it.
On a list of features, like, you know, that
nobody, that can I be real? Hang on.
Explicitly is on a podcast where movies had to be in the movie theater. Go ahead. You do.
Number one, nobody said it had to be features. I got no message telling me it had to be features. Number two, that's an assumption that most people have made.
But it's only part of the podcast.
It didn't have to be. It certainly didn't have to be part of the podcast.
Hey, listen.
It certainly didn't have to be fucking features.
Yeah.
You do what you want to do.
You guys cover Heat Vision. Listen, you guys covered Heat Vision and Jack, so I'm just saying.
Not as a feature.
You open the door. No, I'm okay, but on a serious note, like the fact is, I will tell folks if you check it out, I'll post it on Twitter, whatever. There is Brakhage's films work because they are so evocative. They are images, and quite frankly, to make it all cyclical, on the very first episode I appeared on this show, we were talking about Pikachu's Adventure, and Kenny said, and Phil dismissed it by saying it was just a lot of lights and colors on a screen. And Kenny said, listen, Phil, I've seen movies that are just like experimental film lights and colors, and those can be some of the best films. So fuck it. I put a film that's just lights and colors on the list because, like Kenny says, those can sometimes be some of the best.
I really want to make this very clear. You do you, man.
Yeah.
Totally down with it. Totally down with it. I think you're a total nut job, but that's me.
Yeah. So, Tom, what's your seven? We gotta keep moving.
My number seven
is 75 minutes or longer.
It is a feature length movie that was released in movie theaters for normal human beings to avoid. It is The Straight Story.
Great movie.
It is a beautiful, lovely, not at all what you would expect from David Lynch movie. It's you know, Mike knows this about me. I got a thing about movies about brothers and all this stuff. And it's definitely a movie that when I watch it again is going to hit even harder because my older brother, who I wish at some point in my life we'd be able to have that moment of being able to reconcile the way they do. My brother died last month and I'm never going to have that.
I'm so sorry.
Thank you. I'm never going to have that moment with him. So I feel like movies like this are going to play even harder for me now.
Sure.
But I think it's a beautiful, well-observed movie. I think it might be my second favorite Lynch movie. Cause I'm a psychopath wild at heart's my favorite David Lynch movie.
That's great.
I love it. But Straight Story is beautiful. I really do wish it would get like a nice Blu-ray release in America at some point. Cause I think
It is streaming in 4K on Disney Plus, where all of David Lynch's films are obviously streaming. It was an early one for us, Kenny. I feel like we did that pretty early in the run.
First year, I think.
Yeah.
It's Lynch. It's one of the finest directors who's met several women in his life. And
Two, and two, it is one of those, you know, kind of wild 99 anomalies that is that part. It's part of what made this year so exciting was, you know, Lynch's G-rated movie. You never get that in any other year ever. So that's
it's a really special movie. Mike, six,
number six. Okay, so is this one movie? I'm gonna recommend folks seek it out. It's not the easiest to find. It's not the most well-known. I'm sorry I've created a precedent here, but it's called The Mummy by director Stephen Sommers. You guys are not the biggest fans of it on
I like it, but he doesn't like it.
41, I looked it up.
I think that The Mummy was one of those movies that, I mean, I saw it when it came out. I was addicted to it as a little kid.
Sure.
Every time I go back to it, there is something about it that I just find so compelling, because unlike so many of the 99 movies that are either movies that you guys covered on the show that are either like movies that feel so much like shit that would have been made in the 90s or feel so much like they're way ahead of the times, The Mummy is this weird anomaly that happened once and never again, that was just like, hey, we just made a movie that follows like every structural rule of like classic like 1940s, 1950s action adventure filmmaking. Sure. We figured out how to do it once. It plays to everyone. It works like a fucking charm. And then it is that like Raiders of the Lost Ark level thing of you just like look at it and go, oh, this just emerged like fully formed. Like, here's a fun time. And I think there's something so incredible.
I just want to say to our listeners, you know, that Mike Natale went from the Black Tower to the Dark Mummy Tower. in one move. So don't say that he doesn't contain multitudes. Tom, what is your next movie?
My next movie is a feature from a director I have a very complicated relationship with. Mm. It is his last movie. It is Eyes Wide Shut.
Mm.
I don't love Kubrick.
Mm.
I especially don't like Kubrick after 2001. I don't like 2001. I don't like Clockwork Orange, Barry Lyndon.
Oh, wow.
Okay. I kind of enjoy The Shining. I think it's wildly overrated. I like Full Metal Jacket. Again, kind of wildly overrated. But Eyes Wide Shut is, I think, a stone cold, just fucking weird ass masterpiece. And it's just, I don't know. It just gets its hooks into me. And I love its weird little journey into the depths of hell of a guy who just
wants to get laid.
He wants to get laid, but he's just so cucked by his wife's dreams that he's willing to like visit a prostitute. He's willing, he almost gets sold a child bride. He ends up at a fucking sex party at a mansion in Long Island, and he's just like, he thinks he's this cock of the walk, but every time people are throwing themselves at him, he's just like, yeah, I can't do it.
I've never heard it described as a man driven insane, cucked by his wife's dreams, but that is the perfect way.
That's the movie.
But it's great. Also love that it's the movie that destroyed Tom and Nicole's marriage. Love that little bit of history.
Yeah.
It's an amazing movie. Great movie. And Eyes Wide Shut. What a way to go out.
What do you got, Mike?
All right. So no, but I'm being sincere when I say this, like this is truly one of the most impressive films you'll ever see if you get a chance to see it. It is only 10 minutes long. But I'm serious. Like, seriously. So it's called, if you look it up, guys,
it's just like, what is this bit?
It's not a bit.
My face is not what is this bit. My face is
what's this bit.
I have to get somewhere.
It's called Outer Space. It's by director Peter Jackowski. Peter Jackowski is known for doing just found footage films, and okay. I don't mean like pretending it's actually shot. I mean, he actually edits in Barbara Hershey from the Entity, 10 minutes. It's actually a really effective horror film in just 10 minutes. Look it up, folks.
Fantastic. Outer Space?
Outer Space by Peter Jackowski.
Tom, what do you got? What do you got next?
Next one is Bringing Out the Dead, Martin Scorsese. Yeah. Love that movie. Love when him and Schrader work together. Him and Schrader, I think, make the best movies together. Wish they would make one more before Schrader, you know, dies making a movie.
But I think Bringing Out the Dead is so underrated. Love that movie.
I love the energy. Love it. It's just a great movie. So Bringing Out the Dead.
Mike.
The Blair Witch Project.
That's a movie. There we go.
Only because
two
people
of them
saw
so
it.
Far on this list.
You know, there's some other world where it's not a movie, but good for you. Good for you. That was in theaters.
It's a great movie. That was in theaters. People saw it.
I know this must be humiliating for you, Mike, to have to put a real movie on.
Listen, Kenny's got somewhere to be. I'm just going to rattle off titles now. Blair Witch Project.
What do you got, Tom?
I watched it yesterday and it knocked Galaxy Quest off my list. So it's really high. I watched The Limey. It is maybe the most Tom Lorenzo movie Steven Soderbergh has ever made. It's fucking great. It's 90 minutes long. It zips. It packs a hell of a punch. And Terrence Stamp just growling at people is fantastic. So
it just rules.
You know what rocks about that movie?
Hmm.
I mean, I love this. I really love it. And I might watch that one again before the end. But you know what rocks about it? Terrence Stamp is pretty stupid in the movie. And I really love that about it.
Yeah.
He's like a feral animal. It's great.
Yeah.
He's
great. Yeah. I said it yesterday. More movies need to have main characters where the main character is an idiot who makes everything worse.
Yes. Did you buy the 4K Steelbook, Tom?
Or? Yeah. Yeah. That's how I watched it.
Because I knew
it was coming. So I was like, I'm not going to watch it on fucking Amazon or whatever. I'll just wait for it. The transfer. So there you go. Mike, number three.
Is it three or two?
Three.
Or three.
He put an album. Let's see if he put like an album.
It's Toy Story 2.
Whatever. Mike, I gotta tell you, when you zig, you zig. When you zag, you zag.
I just so really good movie.
It's a great movie.
Who cares? Toy Story 2.
He put an album.
What's your three, Tom?
My number three is The Insider. Sure. Amazing movie. Michael Mann killed it again. I got a soft spot for journalism movies, and this movie it's unbelievable. Just the story told and the way he tells it, and that he zigs out of his typical crime movie thing to make a movie just about people trying to do like the right thing in a world that won't let them do the right thing. Totally. And it rules. And it's his last movie before he gets sucked into the digital filmmaking realm, which I don't mind. I love what he does digital, but it's his last film. Yeah. So, you know, The Insider rules.
What's your two? Let's hear it, Mike.
Eyes Wide Shut.
What's your two? Wait, no, let's keep going. Come on. I really do have to be sorry. Right.
What do you got? Right.
My number two, one of my five favorite comedies of all time, South Park, the movie. It's incredible, one of the funniest fucking things ever made.
It is. It's beyond words. Mike, what do you got? Number one, build it up.
In 1999, I think folks know where this is going, but in 1999, Warner Brothers decided to take a big risk on a crowd-pleasing film that did a lot to kind of combine genres, to combine science fiction and action.
I know what he's doing.
Combine gunslingers and futuristic tech. To combine the past and the present. To create a film that was not only influential, but the soundtrack is immortal. A film that could do so much to make so many things cool, including tiny sunglasses. That's right. There was no way I wasn't going to pick The Matrix.
Oh, look at what he did there. He zigged. I appreciate it. I love that you did it. Pick Wild Wild West, it would have negated your entire fucking list.
Honorable mentions Wild Wild West and Jean-Luc Godard finishing his soir de cinema.
But here's a real question. Mm-hmm. That was a good bit. I enjoyed that. Is Matrix your actual number one?
Yes, there's no argument. The Matrix is a movie that you look at and you... There's movies that I love. I'll just say this. There's movies that I love for a specific reason that... It's not a particular scene or a particular element, but as soon as the credits roll the first time I see it, I just get overwhelmed with the feeling of I just saw something special. I got that with Black Panther. I got that with Blue is the Warmest Color. There's been a few films that I get that with, and The Matrix.
Top Gun Maverick.
Top Gun Maverick, sure.
We've all been there.
Oh. All right, Tom.
That's what I get in Top Gun Maverick, like six times. It was like so many good moments where it just had to whip it out and just start going.
All right, my number one. My number one's The Matrix. I mean,
oh wow,
it's a perfect movie. It changed the world. And when Wake Up by Rage Against the Machine plays, you just ready to go out and just start Heroic. Fucking punching people.
Hell, we're ready to do that when that remix of Dragula plays, and that's early on.
I mean, the whole third act of the movie is maybe the best third act of any blockbuster of all time. The second fucking Smith starts chasing Neo. Just the whole Morpheus, from the Morpheus rescue to the end, the movie is on a whole nother fucking level.
I fully agree.
I feel you guys. I didn't expect at the end of this podcast, because I believe Matrix is currently my number one, and I didn't expect at the end of the podcast to feel that at all. Like, I did not see that coming, but it really is everything you guys are saying. You guys, you're the best. Mike, you literally were our first fan, so that we didn't know. So you validated us, and the fact that you're a really interesting, fun, great guy who will put a 3-minute film on your thing is just icing on the cake. But you made us feel like we were doing this for a purpose way back when. So we thank you for that, and we're thrilled that we became friends. And thank you for bringing Tom into our world. Tom, there's no one like you. And obviously, Phil has fallen in love with you in many ways. But we love having, Tom, you're like my brother in many ways too. So this has really been a wonderful, wonderful, like foursome situation for us. Thrilled. You guys are great podcasters. Keep doing it forever and ever while we are in the retirement home.
You guys are great. I couldn't say it better than Kenny. I'll just say, we really wanted to have you guys back one last time on the 99 podcast. And, this movie is what this movie is, but you guys are the best. I remember vividly Kenny saying to me, have you seen this Mike Natale guy is following us and he's talking to us? And it was a real... It's everything Kenny said. It was a moment when we realized, we were doing this for people that actually were connecting with it. But this was,
yeah, the
been
fact
a blast.
That you're smart is really thrilling to us. Because who knew? I didn't think anyone. I didn't think anyone with four brain cells would listen to this podcast. So
yeah, I genuinely didn't think that it was going to do what it did, and we're so unbelievably grateful to have you guys as friends and in our lives and on these podcasts and. It's been a blast, so we hope that, obviously our paths will cross again in the future, but this was an absolute joy. Truly.
I mean, you guys are going to be on season 3 of You're Missing Out. So cross pretty fucking quickly.
Yeah. I don't know what the batch of movie is.
We're this week. We're figuring out like all the little details of season 3. So you're going to be the first one that gets the list. Kenny doesn't even get the list this season. We just picked a movie for him because it's too perfect.
What did you pick for me
again? I am a fugitive from a chain gang. There has never been a more Kenny Nybart movie.
Looking forward to it.
I requested
the Nachka, and he's Tom. Like, my Russian girlfriend already took it.
I texted Tom, and I'm like, this is the one. Like this is. There's never been a better opportunity to have Kenny on.
Do you have an idea as to what you think I'm going to pick?
I'm not sure. Okay. Because I mean, the thing is, like, this is the difference is that Kenny. The last 2 seasons has basically gone on like, I want to pick something that's going to challenge myself, and I want to pick something that I haven't seen, and this and
what
that.
What were the two movies, Kenny? It was Swing Time and
High Noon, and Top Hat.
Top Hat.
And famously, Kenny showed up on Top Hat, started the episode going, I thought I'd have a lot to say. I have nothing to say about this movie. And then we filmed 90 minutes. So that's why Kenny, we just went, this one's good for Kenny. No, it is a perfect anyway. Phil, I don't know, because you did Sunset Boulevard and All About Eve. You kind of had a particular lane, and there's nothing this season that is in that lane. So I'm very curious to see where that goes.
Right, can't wait.
We just got to work out the details, and then I'm sending you the list once I talk to.
Well, I think I can speak for Kenny when I say we can't wait to be on your podcast when and as frequently as you would like us to talk about whatever you guys want to talk about. You guys are the best.
Well, I just want to say thank you guys. It's still so fucking weird to me that you guys have us on the show and like you guys get like these crazy fucking guests and shit. Like, and then like the next week it'll be like, oh, and then Tom Lorenzo's talking about a movie and he's like ranting and raving about some Belgian woman sucking dicks like a demon from hell. Like, I, it's just, It's so fun, and I do really appreciate. I love you guys a lot. I'm very glad you guys are in my life, and we consider each other friends.
Absolutely.
And it's very weird that this all started fucking like what 4 or 5 years ago with Phil walking into Kyle's tiny Brooklyn apartment. And
to talk about Babe Pig in the City. Yeah, that's how it goes. Yeah.
Still one of our best rated episodes.
And we haven't looked back, and I can't wait to keep doing it in other forms, be it you guys doing new shows or more seasons of our show. So thank you guys for being our friends and for having us on the show. And, you know, love you guys.
You guys are the best.
We love you guys. We'll see you soon.
We'll talk to you soon. Bye, guys.
See you later. Podcast like it.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.